Hello and welcome to the Deep Dive Perspective. And it's my pleasure to welcome ex-UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, civil service warrior now, I'd say a rights warrior, somebody who's stood up and taken on the system in a way which benefits so many of us. And so many people owe a debt to these kinds of people who actually stand up for us and our rights today that often they go unnoticed. Craig Murray, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ben.
Craig, your travels have intrigued me over the last couple of years. We met at the Free Palestine Film Festival for the first time and we hosted a discussion. And then since then, you've been certainly covering Lebanon in a big way. You went out there and lived there for quite some time, covered a lot of the massacres that have been going on. And of course, nobody in the world now can ignore what's going on, not only in terms of the genocide in Palestine, but the mass murders in Lebanon, and of course, Yemen also, and the Bab al-Mandeb and what's going on there. And last but not least, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran, where of course there's been two wars that have been inflicted on them since we last met. And of course, this has brought us all into the crosshairs of what is likely to be the biggest, if you like, jolt to our systems, economically, perhaps politically, and certainly in terms of what the world will look like in the future that I've seen in my lifetime, and perhaps you in yours maybe as well. But what do you make of where we are? And, you know, from that last 2 years of what you've been experiencing, seeing, particularly in terms of Donald Trump and his decisions to go for this kind of war, which can't but affect everybody in the world in a detrimental way. What's your overall outlook to it?
I would say that Donald Trump has succeeded in many of his objectives, but only if you realize that Donald Trump's objectives are nothing to do with the welfare of the ordinary American people.
Right.
You know, Donald Trump has succeeded in making a huge amount of money for Donald Trump. Donald Trump has succeeded in enabling Israel to expand the territory it occupies. Mm-hmm. Those are important goals that he and the people around him have met, and those are their aims. In doing that, he has put the United States in a much weaker position strategically than it was. But, you know, if he's made a few billion for Donald Trump, does he care? Is the question. And Israel is arguably in a stronger position strategically than it was. So I think we need to be clear-eyed. I think it's often a mistake to believe that the political elite work for the welfare of the people of their country, because they don't. They work for the political elite. And once you grasp that basic concept, then understanding what's happening becomes much easier.
It's clearly the case that imperialism, by and large, does this. It's not something new. The stamping out of any threat, any danger that is posed to it, is part of their remit. But they have now come up against, for the first time, what many would argue is a civilizational obstacle. Islamic Republic of Iran is not a small militia. It's not a fighting force, which is a guerrilla force, if you like. It's not a set of people like those in Gaza who are more or less defenseless. It's up against a people who are very conscious of their history and very conscious of American and British imperialist games, if you like, part of the great game, I guess, in Iran. Mossadegh was ousted in 53. The CIA was involved. The British intelligence was involved. The Iranian people know this. And now we've had another demonstration of it in the run-up to the war, the first attack by the Israelis, the 12-day war. It was clear that Mossad and probably the CIA were involved in an insurgency, a huge effort to overthrow. And that has resonated amongst the Iranian people, it seems, very clearly, to the point where they're galvanized behind a leadership which Trump told us would fall, essentially. We've also seen that militarily, Iran has not been defeated in the way that perhaps people would have expected, say, for instance, as Venezuela was, or as Syria was, or as Libya was. So something different has happened. And now we find that Donald Trump has got himself into a situation where he may be making money from the situation, as you're saying. But the closure of the Hormuz is something he can't seem to reverse. And therefore, that is causing a problem to the entire world. And it'll come back to bite America. Perhaps by the time Trump is out of power, it may come in a big way. But certainly, I wouldn't call that a victory as such, certainly for Western imperialism. Or would you say that actually there is a victory there?
I think, again, in the limited terms I described, I don't think Trump is personally too unhappy, even with where he's failed in something that wasn't important to him.
Nice.
He plainly believed that limited Western action, limited American and Israeli action to eliminate the leadership, top leadership cadre of Iran, would result in a public revolution. And that's because they spend much too much of their time listening to the Saudis and listening to Iranian exiles and the small group around the Shah and people who are utterly irrelevant. And they believe what they tell them, which is unfortunately fairly standard for the CIA. It very often has rather poor intelligence. So plainly, Trump believed that the government of Iran would be overthrown by their actions. And that was a miscalculation, there's no doubt. That failed. But of course, Trump is not an idiot. He knew that the Strait of Hormuz would be closed. You know, there's this notion that Trump was the only person in the whole world who didn't know that attacking Iran would result in the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Yeah. They knew that would happen.
Yeah.
And again, Trump and the people close to Trump don't care. It doesn't hurt them if the Strait of Hormuz is closed. In fact, it helps them make rather a lot of money because in a number of ways. One way is simple market manipulation, where Trump, for months, kept giving out false information about where negotiations with Iran stood. Every time he gave out false information, the market and future oil prices would leap one way or the other way, depending on whether he said negotiations were on or they were off. And every time this happened, in the half hour before he made his announcement, there would be massive purchases by people trading with insider information. And I've no doubt at all that Trump personally and those close to him have made huge amounts of money from manipulating the markets.
It was definitely the case that Donald Trump would wait for the weekend when he would order the bombings, because clearly that was the time when the markets weren't going to be affected. And then by Monday, he'd start declaring again that it was all okay and the Hormuz was open. There was this game, and it's still going on. The same thing still seems to happen, although they're not bombing so heavily. Nonetheless, I mean, I take your argument that on a personal and individual level, and for his hierarchy and the people who are making money out of it, clearly they don't care. The rest of the world is now increasingly raising its eyebrows. I mean, his latest trip is all about imposing massive economic sanctions, you know, and he's threatened anybody who does business with Iran. That points directly at China. And it's no joke, because China, of course, is hugely linked into the US economy. It's obviously got a massive need for the oil supplies that come from that part of the world, and any you know, bans on trade of that kind would have reverberations. I've no doubt the Chinese and the Iranians would probably have some sort of arrangements which the Americans can't stop, no doubt as well. But still, there is this indication that Trump does want eventually, or the Americans do want eventually, to deal with China and the rise of China. Do you think the fight in the Hormuz and across Bab al-Mandib and across the maritime waters generally, is far more about their fear of China or their desire to control China's rise. And is that a futile exercise in itself to try and stop China in that way?
To go back a little bit before coming forward, I think the essential point is Trump and the people around him are mercantilists.
Mm.
They're not free traders, they are mercantilists. They believe in the control of trade, the physical control of trade.
I see.
By things, including the physical control of ports and shipping, and by measures like very heavy tariffs and protectionism. It's a way of thinking that went out of fashion in the 18th century when the British Empire switched to free trade as being better for. But
gunboat diplomacy and all that.
But mercantilism, this idea of extremely heavy protectionism and the physical control of trade, is beyond any doubt the guiding philosophy of a Trump administration. And part of mercantilism is you don't hold the view that a rising tide lifts all boats. You have an entirely negative view of other countries doing well.
Right.
So if Asian economies are booming, you don't think, oh, that's great. They'll invest here, we'll trade with them, that's good. You think, wow, these guys are our competitors and they are booming. We should stop them booming. And you must remember the United States gets very little of its oil through the Strait of Hormuz, whereas Asia gets a huge amount of its oil through the Strait of Hormuz. So there are people in the Trump administration, and I believe Trump himself, who actually think closing the Strait of Hormuz is a good thing because it damages China, because it damages India, because it damages Singapore, because it damages all kinds of places that they say in different ways as rivals rather than partners. And it doesn't much damage the United States. The real damage to the United States, of course, is in the fact that it leads to a global rise in oil prices, which damages ordinary people at the petrol pumps. But as I was saying to you earlier, one thing Donald Trump doesn't care a fig about is ordinary people. They're nobodies. So they're struggling to pay their fuel bills. He really doesn't care. He cares a little bit in relation to the November elections. But I think he's written those off already or is planning to claim they were rigged or whatever it is. He's not seriously viewing those as a campaigning platform. So I think you have to see the situation with the idea that although to the rest of the world and to anybody who is sane, the opening of a Strait of Hormuz is sensible. To someone who's an insane, narcissistic megalomaniac like Trump, closing a Strait of Hormuz doesn't hurt me or my oil buddies, oil company buddies. Therefore, he doesn't really care. And I really think he doesn't. Moving on from that to, yes, I mean, they view China as a competitor which must be damaged. And that's why. And of course, now, I've also been in Venezuela where they're doing exactly the same thing in terms of taking physical control of the supply of oil and preventing it from going to China in particular.
Yeah.
And damaging China economically is undoubtedly something which they wish to do. They don't see China as a trading partner. They see China as a dangerous competitor. And of course they should, because there's no doubt that China is now the world's economic superpower.
Yes.
There's also a very strong argument that China is the world's military superpower. They simply don't choose to flex those muscles. It has more and better aircraft carriers than the United States has, for example. But that's not the Chinese way. You know, China doesn't expand through classic imperialism. China, other than Tibet a long while ago, China hasn't made any military advances. It's made
Confucian capitalism is something I've heard it called.
Yeah.
Confucian capitalism.
It's made its advance to world preeminence without conquering any of the countries. And actually, in the history of the world, I can't think of a country that became as economically predominant as China is now without seeking territorial expansion. China's very interesting in those circumstances. But yes, I mean... undoubtedly, the harming of China is something which will be a positive, not a negative. If Trump were able to enforce his measures on Iran, but I don't think he can anyway. as you said, they found in Iran they were taking on a civilization which they were not able to conquer. And, you know, they would also destroy Dubai, for example, if they're serious. You know, Dubai imports massive amounts of stuff, which everybody knows is actually going to Iran as sanctions busting. You know, it's the best kept secret in the Middle East.
Yes.
You know, if you were to prevent Dubai from acting as an entrepôt to Iran, and prevent Dubai from being the center of fake financial transactions that are actually for Iran, the economy of Dubai would collapse. You know, is Trump actually going to do that to Dubai? Mm. Personally, I wish the economy of Dubai would collapse. I think it's a horrible place. But
it certainly is, yeah.
See, the original den of sin and iniquity.
Yeah, crass in the extreme, yes.
Yeah, most nasty, materialistic... Ugh. Can't stand the place. But anyway, the damage that would be done if he was serious to allies, and the United States can't afford to damage. The United States doesn't have the self-sufficiency in manufacturing production nowadays to cut itself off from China. That's a ludicrous threat. So I don't... If I were Iranian, I wouldn't be worried. We know sanctions can be horrible, and we know particularly over medicine, for example. One of the things I discovered in Venezuela was Venezuela now produces a whole range of basic generic medicines. Unfortunately, there are still things that will, you know, that will kill you that wouldn't necessarily kill you if you were elsewhere, because there are certain specialist medicines they can't get in because of sanctions. But for the vast majority of ordinary treatable illnesses with antibiotics and those things, they now produce them themselves, having had no pharmaceutical industry at all 10 years ago. And that's come entirely because of sanctions.
So you build resilient resistance economies as a counterweight to this kind of pressure.
And Iran has already been doing that for years. You know, they will need to do more. And the Iranian people are extremely talented and extremely highly educated, with a huge amount of mineral and other resources. You know, if you need to start building steel foundries and casting your own spare parts for something, there's no shortage of iron, there's no shortage of coal, there's no shortage of people. Iran has the ability to do all that stuff. It's not an easy target.
And that would give local firms zero competition without all these corporate firms coming in. So they've got a market of 90 million, plus they've got access through Pakistan and seven other countries which are bordering them to do trade, I guess, unless Trump can shut those routes off.
Which would be hard for him to do. It's quite interesting. I was reading an article in The Guardian today, I think, about how saying that Iran's going to lose all its leverage because the Saudis are going to build pipelines across the desert, which was interesting in a number of ways. It ignores the existence of the resistance in Yemen, for example, who might have a say in that. But it also ignored the fact that Iran and the Chinese can also build pipelines. The Americans don't control Afghanistan anymore. You know,
there's a corridor right to China through Afghanistan, of course.
Exactly. I don't know how far advanced our plans to build pipelines along that corridor, but it's a very obvious step.
Yeah. The North-South corridor, which I know Pepe Escobar used to talk a lot about, that's still very much on the cards. You know, Russia's still collaborating, and the Zangezur corridor, I think, is the one through Armenia / Azerbaijan, which is like still not off the cards. So Iran has those. It had the ports down in the south, Chabahar port, which was meant to link Indians and their trade through this north-south corridor as well. So these things eventually, one assumes, would go back to normal once this kind of saber rattling's over and America gets what it wants, or the Iranians get some sort of deal. You'd have thought that actually it'll be business as usual again. But do you think after Trump's foray into this kind of idea of subjugating Iran, which he still on verbally is saying. He still thinks he's won the war and he's going to crush them. That's the language he's still using. At some stage, do you think it's just going to be a case of accepting that Iran is now, if not the fourth center of power in the world, certainly able to influence that region far more than it was before, and that America would have to withdraw its footprint, given that their bases have been knocked out, given that its proxies there are quite rattled now with this idea that they're on the front line of the war, not America, and they're being used, essentially, and Iran has made it clear that they won't be left exempt if they continue to support sanctions and other such things. That region will change after all this, do you think?
I think definitely. I mean, Iran's status in the international order, if you like, has increased enormously thanks to Donald Trump. And Iran, having proven its resilience and its ability to stand up to the United States and Israel together, and the fact that, I mean, the Iranian leadership is not a warmongering leadership. Yeah. They are leadership who want a peaceful solution, and have actually been extremely pacific and tolerant and willing to negotiate through years and years of outrageous American and Israeli attacks of various kinds upon them. You know, the good faith of the Iranian government is not in it. Is not in doubt. If the war were to have continued and gone into an all-out war, of course, Tehran would have taken heavy damage. Many, many civilians would have died. Nobody wants that.
No.
But on the other hand, Iran was going to win because the Americans were running out of things they could shoot.
Basically,
and also, you know, the Israelis now must realize. But, of course, they could never defeat Iran on its own militarily. But even with the Americans, they can't defeat Iran. And the Israelis must surely realize that that's a real problem for them in the longer term. But there's one thing we have to mention, which is the American Trump card, if I may use it, and the Western Trump card. And that, unfortunately, is the Sunni-Shia divide in Islam. Because in any sane world, the inhabitants of most of the Arab states would realize that Iran is the regional power, that the protection they thought they had from these American bases is non-existent, that some of the American bases are themselves now non-existent or unmanned or effectively abandoned, and they would look to normalize relations with Iran.
That'd be logical.
That would be logical. Instead, for reasons of a theology which must be so mad that I cannot even begin to countenance, they seem to think that normalizing relations with Israel is better than normalizing relations with Iran because the Iranians are Shia.
Now, seems crazy, yeah.
And forgive me, because it's maybe, I don't intend to be disrespectful by speaking of a religion which is not my own religion. But
no, but you're right.
It makes no sense.
It makes no sense. And I guess that will dictate whether the Chinese, etc., and maybe the Russians can play a bigger role in that. Although Russia had to pull out of Syria, given the circumstances that emerged, over a sustained attack by the Anglo-Zionist Empire and wresting control of Syria from the hands of Assad, and of course the Iranian and the Russian influence there. That was a major victory for the empire, if you like. And I suppose that was a template which probably encouraged them to go for this round of wars as well. I mean, I'm bringing Russia into the equation now and thinking, well, these Arabs who might not go running to Iran, but are now don't trust the Americans. Do you think there's a possibility that China and Russia would play a bigger part in terms of being potential partners, you know, Eurasian axis and all that?
It seems plain that China doesn't want to. Mm. You know, there's a massive opportunity for China now to expand its presence. In fact, I would say it's very likely that China would be able to set up military bases in the region now if it wished to. It would find people willing to host them.
Yes.
But China just doesn't want to. It just doesn't seem to fit with their fundamental philosophy, which involves avoiding foreign entanglements. I was very devastated when the Board of Peace resolution was passed through the United Nations Security Council. Mm. I'd actually been at the United Nations in New York lobbying against it a couple of weeks before it actually went through. And I was fairly convinced the Americans and the Chinese would veto it. Anybody would imagine the Americans and the Chinese would veto it. And
so the Russians and the Chinese.
Sorry, I apologize. Yeah. I was convinced the Russians and the Chinese would veto it. And then they didn't.
No.
And that, for me, that was a key moment, if you like, that illustrated the unwillingness of the Russians and Chinese to commit to the region at the moment or to stand forcibly in the way of the Americans. Mm. I mean, I did ask an extremely senior Russian diplomat, who I shan't name, why they didn't veto it. And he laughed and he said, "Never interrupt your enemy when he's making a mistake."
That's a classic, yeah. That old chestnut, yeah.
Which is a nice way to think about it. But but it doesn't actually help the Palestinians. But I think it is a sign. Of course, once the Ukraine war is over, and I think even though...
This is what I wanted to come on to next, yeah.
I think it won't be too long. Then Russia will again be able to devote more resource to...
It's totally sucked in by the Ukraine scenario at the moment in terms of resources. I get that. And I guess the saber-rattling against the Russians, that's where our British and European friends come in. Mm. They seem to be adamant that in some way they want to provoke the bear into confrontation, which is wider than just Ukraine as well. The actions that comes from Burnham or from Starmer previously, they've all been very provocative, I'd say.
It's completely mad. Absolutely mad. And again, the percentage of the public who want war with Russia is extremely small, but there's nobody they can vote for who's opposed to it.
Yeah.
You know, when a state is at war, if you are knowingly giving weapon supplies and plans for missiles to that state, to a belligerent state, in order that it can attack the other one, you know, that's very close to being a part of a war yourself. Russia would have a justification for declaring war on the UK if it wished to. Thankfully, it doesn't wish to. But this notion that Russia is our enemy, this Russophobia, it's interesting that racism against Russians has become the socially acceptable racism in the intellectual classes.
Interesting.
You can go to any dinner party of Guardian readers and make jokes about Russians being drunk and fat and ugly and having glamorous girlfriends, and that's acceptable. Everyone will laugh. You can't, thankfully, in liberal company, make jokes about other races. You can make any joke you like about Russians. There's a real racist element to this mad anti-Russian propaganda. The notion that Russia at any stage has ever had a plan to invade the UK... it's just nonsense. It has not at ever any time in its history ever contemplated invading the UK.
Yeah.
And then you have, we won't go into it now, but you have all these extraordinary stories like the whole Novichok farce in Salisbury, which never happened.
invented by our intelligence
services. To cause causes of conflict.
Mm. Well, the Russian the Russians are being very, very circumspect, very patient. And if they do manage to achieve what their objectives in Ukraine, then in a way they don't need to. Then they proved their point. They don't need to do anything. They are self-sufficient. I think that economically, even in spite of the war, they've still been growing stronger. Their relations with China are very healthy. They're very strong with Iran as well. And so they've got their very pragmatic, very realistic policy. They're not moral. They're not a moral army. You know, Russia's not going to turn up and fight for anybody around the world on a moral basis. Say Iran claims, well, Iran says it does it for the Palestinians. It says it does it for the oppressed in the region. Very few other nations will talk in those terms. They're just more like, we're defending our territory. Mother Russia is prime, and anybody threatens us, we'll take them out. But they're not really looking at expansionism beyond what they've done in Ukraine. That was really an act of resistance, many would argue, against NATO encroachment and the constant push forward and going against treaties that they'd made with the Russians, agreements they had with them. And then, of course, then you can't deny that the Ukrainians did have a Nazi element, which was actually doing a lot of harm to Russian, ethnic Russians in the Donbass and whatever. These are all there. Mainstream media won't touch these issues, but these are facts on the ground that Russia had probably every right to go in and defend people there, technically, although it did invade a foreign country. So technically, it's at fault there. But,
I've always taken the view, which I still hold to, that the Russian invasion of Ukraine was justified, but not legal. Something can be morally correct, but still against the law, because the law is not always moral.
But the law is not always moral.
There's stories that people don't know, people don't realize. You know, people don't realize that pretty well half of the population of Ukraine was Russian-speaking, native Russian-speaking. And they closed all the Russian schools, they closed the Russian universities, they closed Russian bookshops, they closed Russian theaters, they closed Russian cinemas, they've taken action against the Russian Orthodox Church. They've tried to systematically destroy the culture of, you know, the oppression level against the Russians in Ukraine was becoming unbearable. And interestingly, almost all those things I've just said are true of Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia as well, where, again, this institutionalized racism against Russians is becoming a part of Western society.
Well, Trump played an interesting card, didn't he? I mean, he literally went against his own NATO allies on the surface. So he was kind of making out that he was going to resolve this war between Russia and Ukraine. He wasn't going to support the Ukrainians. He put the heat on Zelensky publicly as well. But the money and the weapons have still flowed to Zelensky. I don't think they've stopped in any way. But Trump still keeps this kind of narrative going that he's not for the war.
Well, I think the Americans have stopped a lot. It's now the Europeans who are sending the money.
So it's entirely European back now.
There's still some. I mean, I wouldn't say American side is totally cut off.
Right.
But it's certainly greatly reduced under Trump. And the Europeans are pumping tens of billions in both cash and weapons into Ukraine, and a very large proportion of those tens of billions are just stolen by the most corrupt oligarchy in the world.
Bankrupting itself. Europe is really investing in a war it can't afford. Its own industries are going down the tube. They've stopped Nord Stream, so they can't get cheap gas and oil from the Russians, which was their main supplier. And they've also stopped probably Ukrainian agriculture, which was supplying a lot of it was the granary of Europe, it was said. I mean, on all fronts, they've just kind of done something which is going to harm their own public. Again, rather like Trump in the Hormuz.
Yeah, and if a war goes on much longer, they'll become landlocked. On top of which, they've destroyed relations with Poland. People don't realize this. Ukrainian-Polish relations are now at rock bottom. To the extent that Zelensky had to return, Zelensky was awarded the highest honor of Poland, the Order of the Wisła or something, or the Order of the White Eagle. And the president of Poland ordered him to return it. They revoked it because the Ukrainians keep insisting on glorifying and building statues to Nazi Ukrainian battalions that massacred hundreds of thousands of Poles during the Second World War. And this glorification of Nazism still goes on. It's entirely denied or ignored in the West, but it's absolutely...
The Azov brigades and whatever were well documented.
It's absolutely awful. But Ukraine is on its way to become... to landlocking itself. The Russians are advancing. The area of most Russian advance is along the coast towards Odessa. They've fallen out with Poland. They've got Belarus to the north. They're going to become a landlocked country if this war goes on much longer, which is not in their interest at all. They need the Black Sea for their grain exports. It's a disaster for Ukraine, and the whole thing could have been resolved at the start. You know, there was a peace deal available back in 2022 where the Ukrainians would have kept more land than they still hold now. It's ludicrous. The situation gets worse and worse for them by the day, and it's only going to get worse. And the notion that Russia will surrender Crimea without a world war, literally, you know, for Russia to give up Crimea would require a world war. What are we trying to actually achieve here? And at the most basic level, you know, the areas of Russia, those areas of Ukraine, which Russia now occupies, are only those areas which were almost entirely Russian-speaking areas with almost entirely Russian populations. Do I care who is going to be mayor of Lugansk enough to have a world war over the subject? Most people had never heard of these obscure towns in eastern Ukraine that Russia now occupies. And it's only a small percentage of Russian territory. In fact, the last time an opinion poll could be taken, the percentage of Ukrainians who wanted to be part of Russia was 19%. The amount of land in Ukraine that Russia now occupies is about 22%.
Wow.
So that's fine. You know, let Russia keep that.
Yeah.
And then those Ukrainians who want to be Russian can live there and be Russian. You know, the idea that a state... There had never been a Ukrainian state until 35 years ago.
Sure.
In history, there never was any Ukrainian state or anything but was a de facto Ukrainian state by another name.
Yeah.
There had never been an independent Ukrainian state. It's not like Scotland, that was an independent state from 900 till 1700. Ukraine had never been a state.
Well, that's a cause very close to your heart, and we're going to have a special program on that one. I'm all for Scottish liberation and independence, so yeah, we'll do that.
But the idea that the borders of an entirely artificial state, which never existed until 35 years ago, the idea that moving the border of that state a wee bit should justify a world war when it's an entirely newly created state,
madness.
It's totally mad. Just no rational, logical person thinking properly would think that was a good idea.
Well, when I listen to you, I think of maybe the British Foreign Office maybe 40, 50 years ago, perhaps, when the Soviet Union was playing its part in creating a balance in the world, I suppose you could put it. But post-Soviet era, post the British Foreign Office being the way it was, we're now in an era where it seems that government has less and less power. The intellectual levels within the government apparatus seem to be weaker. You'd probably be able to tell me. And as a last thought, as a former civil servant, as somebody who's been an ambassador in that part of the world as well, what would you do to bring about peace now there?
I think there's a very ready peace agreement available. I think Russia would be prepared to give up some of the land it holds, particularly along the coast, in exchange for peace. I think there needs to be a guarantee that NATO will not cite weapons in Ukraine which are capable of attacking Russia. And those are the basics. The rest of it are free trade agreements. I don't think Russia would be opposed to Ukraine's eventual membership of the European Union. Some of these wouldn't be the Russian opening positions, but that's my informed opinion of what might be achieved in negotiations. So I think you could see a very secure Ukraine with secure boundaries, with a good economy, with good trading positions, and able to join the European Union. And I think that we could be there in 6 months. So if people would accept this is time to negotiate. Russia has no desire to destroy Ukraine. I mean, that's a Western narrative which is entirely false. The idea that Russia is trying to destroy and take over the whole of Ukraine is a complete nonsense. What they're looking for is a place for those people, currently Ukrainian citizens, who wish to be Russian citizens, to live their life in peace and enjoy their Russian culture. I don't see why that's such a huge problem. And I don't think the negotiation is a difficult one. I really don't. Mm. I do think the Russians would be willing to negotiate once the West indicated a willingness to negotiate.
As we're on to solutions, and in the last 3 minutes of the program, two other solutions from you with your ex-civil service hat on. The resolution to the Hormuz and to the struggle against Iran, the US, what would be your recommendations for creating a peace there?
Well, I think Iran needs to receive reparations. Iran was attacked. Iran needs substantial reparations. There can be an agreed traffic transit passage through Hormuz. I don't think that should include the penal levels of fees. I don't think that's a good precedent for the world. We've already seen the UK try to block the Dover Straits to Russian traffic, for example. Mm. I think everybody loses if people around, if all the straits around the world, you know, there's the Bosphorus, of course, as the entry to the Baltic. There's the Malaccan Strait, for which over the world trades pass.
Mm.
Huge. I think we should avoid a situation where trade is constrained too much. But a basic peace agreement which limits... It can't limit Iran's ability to defend itself. And one final say on that. I think if Iran doesn't acquire a nuclear weapon, they are crazy. If I were Iranian, acquiring a nuclear weapon would be the very top of my list of things to do, because Israel has nuclear weapons and the Israelis have shown they are mad and uncontrollable.
Well, I know that when we talk about sanctions and you talked about, you know, reversing all that, you know, there was a... Colonel McGregor was, I think, on record on one of the Danny Haipong shows recently. He talked about 38 million people having been killed by the US imperialist sanctions. So when we talk about sanctions even, this is actually real lives that are lost, half a million in Iraq as a result. But, you know, so it's not war kills people in one way, but then the follow-up with this kind of economic strangulation and these struggles over economic corridors, they cost lives too. And my final one, and probably the central one, one-state solution for Palestine. What's the real solution? I mean, we've got the Board of Peace saying that they want to create whatever they want to create. Israel seems to want to push for this greater Israel concept. And there is a two-state solution which still lingers in the minds of many romantics. And at the same time, there is an increasing shout for a referendum for Palestinians and a one-state Palestine, which actually means that Zionism has to go. The whole thing has to change. What's your solution to Palestine?
Well, I mean, there is no two-state solution. It's plainly impossible. Mm. There's not enough of Palestine left for a two-state solution. On top of which, why would you want to entrench a racist state? Now, Israel is a racist apartheid state. Even if you were creating two separate racist apartheid states, so it'd still be racist apartheid state. You know, there should be one single secular state of Palestine. And it should be based upon land ownership in 1946, land ownership before the Nakba. Any Jewish people whose property, their land, or their home was owned by their ancestors back in 1946 should be able to stay. The rest, they can perhaps stay, but they have to give up their land and property and find somewhere else to live, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
The land must be given back to the Palestinians, and the starting date should not be 1967. The starting date should be 1946, because everything that has happened since has been proven to be illegitimate, no matter what the founders may have hoped, or the Western people who supported hoped. It became a totally illegal, apartheid, racist, colonial project, which cannot be trusted and cannot be allowed to continue. There'll be no peace in the world until Israel simply disappears as an entity.
Well, you've given us a big direction, a signpost of where perhaps the justice is and where peace lies with those three solutions. It was a brave little crystal ball exercise. We can only pray that most of what you've just said actually comes about and is made to come about by the masses. Clearly, those in power and those who are greedy for power and those who are belligerent and have those kind of weapons of mass destruction don't seem to want it to go that way. So there is a struggle on for all of us. We all have to be part of, I guess, the resistance that achieves these objectives to create real peace. Otherwise, without justice, you're right, there can't be peace.
I think that's very important, that everybody in the world is part of this struggle.
Mm.
The Iranians have been facing their own struggle against military attack. The struggle of the Palestinians has been awful. Struggle of the Lebanese, a struggle in Lebanon. We all know those struggles. We all think of those. We, too, all of us, those of us who live in the West, we, too, are suffering from these oppressive regimes and these billionaire class taking all. You know, it is our struggle as well. It is not just that we have to join a struggle to support the Palestinians who are suffering. We have to struggle for ourselves, to reclaim our own agency and our own rights. So there is at the moment a universal struggle of which everyone is a part, whether they realize it yet or not.
I usually give a conclusion to my shows. You've just concluded everything for me, but I will give you the opportunity to plug any campaign that you want people to support at the moment as well, just as a sort of gesture for our audience to support some of the things that you're doing.
That's very kind. If you go to my website, which is just my name, craigmurray.org.uk, you'll find there places where you can sign up to support in particular. And I'll be open. We need financial support because it's very expensive to support the legal battles for the review of Palestine Action's prescription. And any money left over goes to individual legal battles of those facing charges, many of whom are pensioners and people without much money to pay for legal support. So anything you can do along those lines. But also, if you follow my blog, you'll see often, very often, there are actions which are taken, demonstrations, rallies, court actions, where we want people to turn up and support. So you don't need to have money to be able to be useful. And one final thing I will say to people, because one great difficulty is these things are terribly expensive to keep going, and we're always getting the same good people putting their hand in their pocket. If you know any people who actually have money, because those of us on our side of politics tend not to have any money, but because we're not part of a capitalist system, if you know good people who actually really have money, then speak to them and get them to donate either to our legal actions, to medical action for Palestine, or for any of those who are fighting to try to make the world better. Because the struggle to keep humanitarian action going is becoming very, very hard. And we need people who actually have resources to help with it.
Thank you very much, Craig. And same goes for us in the media, because we're also taking on mainstream media. Any pennies you have left in the wallets after you've contributed to Craig and his causes will be gratefully received by Deep Dive Perspective as well. But, you know, I know there's a lot of people doing great work. We're just doing our bit, trying our best, and hopefully we can survive long enough to be able to get our message across. We've certainly done it today. Craig, thank you very much for your coming into the studio, taking the time and the trouble, and we wish you the best of luck on all of your battles and all the fronts you take on, and may there be victory for the resistance, global resistance, which you've emphasized. It's not a resistance that is far away. It's one that exists here and it needs support, and we're certainly with you. Thank you for watching this edition of The Deep Dive Perspective. Until the next show, goodbye.